It is time to bring in Arthur Schwartz. Arthur, of course, joins us on a Monday morning. We broadcast him on the weekend and also after our noon hour during the week. No, it's not. Well, anyways, I'm sorry about that initial loop up on our telephone system, but it's time to talk about recipes.
Or whatever.
Or whatever. That's right.
I didn't have to look this up, because I'm an old-time food editor, and I know my holidays and what you're supposed to write about on the different holidays. So it's Martin Luther King Day, mm-hmm. and every year since it became Martin Luther King Day, there are stories about what were his favorite foods. And they're all the likely suspects. I mean, he was a Southerner. He was from Georgia. So he likes, you know, smothered everything, including, I had a note this a few years ago, smothered steak. And I'm thinking, what's smothered steak? I didn't know that one. But then I realized, if you're poor, and many of us are, or were, you can't afford, you know, really good steak. Like, you can grill and be tender and delicious. You have to braise meat, because it's inexpensive cuts of meat that you can afford. So braised steak is probably not steak at all. I mean, it's some kind of chuck, I'm thinking, cut into slices like a steak. Reminds me of the Neapolitan dish, steak alla pizzaiola, which means steak in the fashion, in the mode, in the style of the pizza maker, the pizzaiola, aola. And the pizza maker, the most basic pizza in Naples is called, and of course, pizza, as we know, it was invented in Naples. It's evolved, but and they still make the creative, but also the traditional pizzas. So the most basic pizza in Naples is called marinara, and it's just the pizza dough baked with a topping of tomatoes, oregano, and garlic. Now, if you add cheese to that and some basil, it becomes a margherita. But the more basic than a margherita is a marinara. But they don't call the dish steak marinara. They call it steak a la pizza. It's very confusing. but it's the topic for a marinara pizza, but put on steak. So, flashback 30 years ago, I knew all about steak pizzaiola because it was an Italian American dish too. I mean, you could get it in a pizzeria. In fact, I always wanted to write a story when I was working at the Daily News called "Eating at the Back of Pizzerias," because sometimes in the front of the pizzeria, of course, they're serving pizza, but they're often, at least in the old days, well, 25 years ago, there was a back room where you could get more than pizza. And there were a few places in Brooklyn that I used to go to eat in the back room. Anyway, back to steak pizzaiola. So the other day, so 25, 30 years ago, I knew all about it, but I'm in Naples researching my book, Naples at Table, and I go to cook in the kitchen of the fanciest traditional restaurant in Naples, and no longer exists. COVID really did it in. And the chef, whose name is, you know, I'm old, I don't remember names. I can't remember his name, but I remember him very well. And he, as a young man, maybe a teenager, went to London to become a chef. And to, I think he even went to culinary school in London. He spoke perfect English, obviously. And he came back to Naples for a visit to his family and to his hometown, and he fell in love with a local girl, and she didn't want to leave Naples, so he moved back to Naples. So now he's cooking in the fanciest restaurant in Naples. He was very proud of this, of course, and a hometown boy, but with a more international perspective. And he said to me, you know, there's no reason. Because steak pizzaiola is a way of cooking, as Martin Luther King liked his braised meat, which is what smothered steak is. Neapolitans love their version of braised meat, which is steak pizzaiola. But this chef said to me, you know, there's no reason in the world you can't have a good steak a la pizzaiola. It doesn't have to be some kind of, you know, cheap, tough cut of meat that you have to cook for hours to make it palatable and delicious sometimes. So he used to make at this restaurant a New York strip steak. And then he would put on top of it, he would deglaze the pan with tomatoes, crushed tomatoes, canned tomatoes, by the way, oregano, lots of oregano, dried oregano, and chopped garlic, not sautéed first, just everything put in the pan at once, cooked for a few minutes, scraping up any little fond, any browned bits at the bottom of the pan from cooking the steak, and then put the steak back in for a minute on each side, just to heat it through again, and you've cooked the steak probably rare or medium rare, so it won't hurt the steak at all. So I did this last night, but I also did the old-fashioned one earlier this week because my preferred cut of meat for the old-fashioned long-cooked pizzaiola is chicken steak. Now, that's a name, that's what's called in the butcher business, a fanciful name. It is a cut of meat that, in fact, is reasonably tender in part, but in fact also has a line of cartilage that goes down the middle. That's how you recognize the steak. It's an oval shape, not a steak. It's a slice of chuck. I went to my butcher a number of years ago, and I asked him, oh, could you give me some chicken steaks? And he said, what's a chicken steak? Because these fanciful names don't necessarily carry over from one place to the next. And the other day I did find in the supermarket, and they were prime meat, too. They were labeled prime anyway. Chicken steaks, very reasonably priced, in my supermarket where I rarely buy meat. But I bought these. And what I did was I browned the meat, like you do in any braise, in just a trace of olive oil in the pan, because the meat will render some fat itself. And in fact, if you have more, after you've browned the meat and set it aside, if you have more fat in the pan than you really want, you can pour it out. But of course, don't pour out any of that brown stuff on the bottom of the pan that from cooking the meat. And then put in your tomatoes. Now, of course, the amounts depend on the amount of meat. I had 6 half-inch thick chicken steaks. I don't know. It wasn't much more than 2 pounds. And I used 1 28-ounce can of tomatoes. Must have been at least 2 really, really big, I know me, big cloves of garlic, finely chopped. And 2 big pinches of oregano. It depends on your oregano, you know, how much oregano to use and the kind of oregano you use. I happen to have really recherche oregano. You know, hand-picked on the hills of Sorrento by little boys. And then their daddy sells it on the road, dried. So I have this oregano, and all I need is 2 big pinches of this oregano. It's very fragrant. If you're using, you know, something you bought in the supermarket and it's been on your shelf for a while, you may want to use more than 2 big pinches. And salt and pepper. Yeah, I use a little hot pepper, a little 1 or 2 little hot dried peppers, and let it simmer a minute or two. That's all. Put the steaks back in. And cover the pan, and let it simmer gently for mine took a good hour and a half. So it's braised meat. It's, as Martin Luther King liked to say, smothered steak. But last night I actually did have a good steak, and I did just what the chef in Naples told me. I seared my steak very well in my cast iron pan. That was. It was 3 minutes each side. That's my usual rule. That produces medium rare to rare steak. Depends on how you like your steak. You can do a little longer. If I was doing it a little longer, I would turn down the heat after searing the meat and just let it sit 1 minute more on each side, and then take it out of the pan. And then what I put in the pan was a good cup and a half of quartered those Campari tomatoes, the little, they call them cocktail tomatoes. I find that's about the best tomato you can get in January. They're grown in Mexico, so they have lots of warmth in Mexico. Don't buy the ones from Canada. They're not nearly as good as the ones from Mexico, even though they may be the same brand name, I've noticed. Anyway, a nice amount of tomatoes, which I let sit with some olive oil and minced garlic and oregano, and this was all prepped ahead. So as soon as the steak was done, or at least cooked the way I wanted it, I put all those, there was very little fat in the pan. If there is too much fat, it depends on your steak, you can pour off some fat. Then I put all the tomatoes in, I gave it a good stir, and I turned off the heat, and this took no more than two or three minutes. And I like to let the steak sit for a few minutes. So, and we like it rare to medium rare. So that's what the steak ended up being. And what I did was I sliced it. In Italy, they would say a tagliata. It sounds so fancy. Tagliata. It just means sliced steak. And Mr. Harned likes his steak pre-sliced. Get less work for Daddy. Anyway, so I sliced the steak, and I poured all these tomatoes with the garlic and oregano on top. And that was my steak pizza. Less. It was very good. I must say, and Harned, who is not as much of a steak lover as I am, said, "I hope you make this again." So that was a hit.
I love
now,
steak. Yeah.
The other hit is a really. So I'm cleaning my office now. What do you do during COVID if you're stuck in the house? By the way, even though I'm eligible for a vaccine, try to get one. I don't know what's going on today. But the mayor predicted at the end of last week that the city would be out of vaccine by today. My next-door neighbor got vaccinated yesterday, although I'm going to call her and find out how that went, because I know people have been turned away when they get there. So I've decided not to stress myself over this and to just stay in like I've been for 9 months. So if you're in the house, I'm cleaning closets. I'm trying to get something done here. And now I've started on my office, and I excavated these two big baskets full of recipes that I've clipped. And sometimes I rummage through them to find something to eat for dinner, but I haven't rummaged through them in quite a while. But right on, I didn't even have to go very far, because sort of right on top of one of them was this recipe. And I swear, this recipe is haunting me. It's chicken with shallots. Chicken thighs, my favorite part of the chicken, with shallots. I love any kind of onion or garlic or allium is the family of things. And this has lots of caramelized, I love that word too. I wish people would say caramelized, but they do. It's caramelized shallots. Anyway, I say it's haunting me. I see I clipped this from the New York Times Magazine in 2014, but in the 6 years since then, six and a half years I see, since then, I have come across a version of this in so many places, and I even was served this, forgetting that I had clipped this recipe from the Times. I was even served this by a friend for dinner one night, and she served this, and she said, "Oh, this is a great dish because, for every day, but also for company, because you can make it ahead and just stick it in the oven for a bit." Anyway, the recipe has an incredible history. It ends up reading the one page of the two-page article that I clipped. And this particular version that I'm looking at comes from Rashia Zimmern. She is the wife of Andrew Zimmern. Do you ever watch Andrew Zimmern on TV?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, he's one of the few that I actually stop when I see him.
I like him because he's a little off the wall.
Well, I don't think he's so off the wall, but he likes to do off the wall food.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He you know, he does adventures. And I actually record some of them because they're cities that I figure I'm going to get to. I'm not going to get to, you know, some of the really exotic places he's going, but I'm interested to see what they're eating there. Anyway, and so Andrew got, Andrew's wife actually was inspired to create this recipe by way of Martha Stewart. I must say, the Times really gave all credit where it was due. Adapted from Andrew and Rishia Zimmern by way of Martha Stewart. But now it's going to be by way of Arthur Schwartz because I don't know. I don't think this recipe is exactly what I want. Here's what you do. You brown, it's a chicken saute, my specialty these days. We eat a lot of braised chicken thighs, meaning you brown the chicken thighs in a skillet, or I use a saute pan, which is a straight-sided skillet, basically, with high sides. And I, mine has a nice cover, so that's why I use it a lot. But I just bought a universal cover. Do you know what a universal cover is? It fits any size pan.
Yep.
But the one that I got is a little cumbersome. It's a Kuhn Recon. It's very heavy stainless steel, overbuilt as most Kuhn Recon things are, which is why I like them. I mean, they're sturdier than sturdy. But it's a little uncomfortable. So now, when I'm going to make this, in fact, later today, I'm going to use my wide skillet. I'll tell you why in a second, which is, you know, wider than my sauté pan, because now I have a universal cover, and I have a cover that will fit my 12, at least a 12-inch skillet. So you brown the chicken in a tiny bit of oil. Now, the Zimmerns flour their chicken before, very lightly, but they flour it before browning it. And that would, of course, help to thicken the sauce that comes later, that, you know, that's created in this pan. But I think I might leave that out. So they brown in butter. Then they take the chicken out and put in their shallots. I'm going to use two smallish shallots per thigh. So I'm going to make six thighs. I'm going to have a dozen shallots. And you brown the shallots in what's left in the pan, which is now a mixture of butter and chicken fat. And then you add your liquid, which in their case is 2 cups of white wine. Now, as somebody who makes chicken sautés all the time, I will say that's a lot of white wine for even 8 chicken thighs, which is what they use. But here's the thing. It's about pans and pan size. I'm looking now, you can't go by the picture in the New York Times because that was styled. For instance, the chicken is still very well browned. After you braise it for at least 30 minutes in a covered pan, it is not going to be browned anymore. The skin will no longer be browned. So that was a trick. And the shallots that they put on top, I swear, were never cooked in the sauce. They put them aside. This is in the picture. And there are these beautifully caramelized, even a little blackish shallots on top. So, I don't know. It's not going to look like the picture. But they are using a very wide pan here. And I'm thinking, you know, they use 2 cups of dry white wine. If I did it in my 12-inch skillet, that might be the right amount of wine. But since I always use my 10-inch sauté pan, it's too much white wine. In fact, I often do, well, not often, but often enough, make chicken mole now that I have a source of homemade mole paste. and I use 2 cups of water to poach my chicken in, and that doesn't even thicken. 2 cups of liquid in the pan, which gets to be more once you cook the chicken in it, not less actually. It is a lot of liquid. So I'm gonna do this today, but I'm gonna do it in my wide skillet and see what happens. I think in the wider skillet, the 2 cups might be okay. And then you flavor the white wine. This is the liquid in the pan with 2 tablespoons of Dijon mustard. And here is the ingredient I didn't have in the house, when I first wanted to make this, when I discovered the recipe in the pile of recipes, is tarragon. So I have tarragon now. I went out and bought some tarragon. Two sprigs, whatever that means. I like a nice amount of tarragon. If I'm going to use tarragon, it is an herb that can take over. So if you don't love tarragon, be careful. If you use a small amount of tarragon, it'll just sort of meld in. Anyway, that's it. You cover the pan. You simmer for about 30 minutes. Take the cover off. And now the Zimmern recipe tells you to cook the sauce down for another 15 to 20 minutes. This is why I'm a little suspicious of the amount of sauce. The amount of liquid, it seems an awful lot. And then to cook the chicken for another 15 to 20 minutes after it's cooked, covered for 30 minutes, and also sautéed, takes about 8 minutes to brown the chicken. It's a long time. 10 to 15 minutes more on the chicken would be my max. And we'll see. I'll tell you. Now, the final Philip here, that's Philip, F-I, Philip, is our cherry tomatoes. And I happen to have some really good, for a change, cherry tomatoes. And the Zimmerns tell you to have the cherry tomatoes and stir lightly into the hot dish and then serve immediately. I'm thinking I might want to cook those tomatoes a couple of minutes anyway, just to give them a more cooked feel. Anyway, this is going to be a late lunch today. Chicken with shallots and cherry tomatoes.
Sounds great.
Very, yeah, it does, doesn't it? So I said this has been haunting me since 2014. I've been wanting to make this recipe. I got served it at somebody's house. It keeps popping up on the internet. It must be hugely popular. And by the way, there must be many versions of it now. And Martha Stewart started the whole thing. I wonder if she ever makes it.
I can't, you know, Martha Stewart is actually, what is she now, 80 years old?
Oh, come on.
No, she is.
I don't think she's quite 80. I'm 73, and I know she's older than me, but I don't think she's 10 years old. No, she's in her late 70s. We could look it up easily enough.
You know, I've gone through the many stages of Martha Stewart. I didn't like her in the beginning, many, many years ago.
Yeah.
After she went to prison, I started to like her because she was you know, lots of men didn't go to prison for what she did, and since she's been out of prison, she's reassembled her life, and I kind of enjoy her now and everything that she puts out.
Well, let me say she's 79.
Okay,
she was born August 3rd, 1941, and she was born in Jersey City. I knew she was from New Jersey. Listen, I know Martha for more than 30 years. I know her since she was married to Andy Stewart, who was a very nice man. And I only knew him through publishing. He was the founder of Stewart, Tabori, and Chang, the publishing house. And I had a big few. Well, so Martha and I were friends for quite a while, and then she became Martha Stewart. And we weren't such good friends anymore, but she was on my radio program all the time, and I tolerated her because she was friends with Joan Hamburg, my radio wife.
Yeah.
But then the two of them ganged up on me one day. Now, I couldn't get a divorce from my radio wife, but I definitely could get a divorce from Martha. So she was horrible to me on my own radio program. So I stopped talking to her. So years go by, and I'm at a party. I don't remember for what. Some kind of publicity party. And Mike Wallace and his wife were there. And I had never met Mike Wallace, but he was the hero of my college years because he was the most famous guy in my college fraternity, Phi Epsilon Pi. So I went over to him. And I said, "Oh, excuse me, Mr. Wallace. I was in Phi Ep at Maryland, and you were our big hero." And I couldn't remember the secret password or the handshake, which we had, but he did. And we were bonded, you know, fraternity brothers. In walks Martha with her date, who was the art director of Martha Stewart Living magazine. And I was standing with Martha's food editor, Lucinda Quinn. And Lucinda, I don't know, somebody who Lucinda worked with in the kitchen. We were just sitting and chatting, standing and chatting, in the same little circle as, at this point, Mike Wallace and his wife, and there may have been another couple of people, you know, everybody gathering around Mike Wallace. And Martha walks in, and she walks over to our little group, and she says hello to everybody except me, because we were feuding.
Yeah.
And Mike Wallace said to her, "Martha, you said hello to everybody except Arthur. That was rude." I loved him for that, right? Anyway, so Martha said hello to me. A couple of years go by. I wrote my Jewish cookbook, and Martha invited me on her TV program to cook my famous brisket. And I must say, that particular brisket that we cooked on the Martha Stewart Show was the best brisket of my life. And it comes from DeBraga, by the way, the company that I buy my steaks from when I'm in the mood for a sensational steak and other meat. So DeBraga was the regular provider of meat for her program. So Martha came in to the I was in the kitchen making sure that all the food we were going to do was up to my standard. It was beyond standard because they were really pros in that kitchen. And Martha walks in, very sleepy-eyed, no makeup. I realized she had been probably sleeping in the car. She was living in Bedford then. And she got, you know, limoed into the city to do her program. And I'm sure she was, like, sleeping in the car because she came into the kitchen to make herself breakfast. And she scrambled a couple of eggs for herself. And while I was standing there with her, she got really personal and told me things that she shouldn't have told me, probably. And I realized this was her way of, what's the word I want, Marshall? Of reconciling.
Yeah.
So that was it. And I've seen her a couple of times since then. She's always very cordial. But so I agree with you. She's gotten nicer with age. She's kinder, I guess. Anyway, she's on TV. She's got her own program, and I don't know. She's a judge on the food shows. So this all started with chicken, with shallots, and cherry tomatoes. And Martha is not a creative cook, to her credit. Yeah. She's a very traditionalist, to her credit. So I don't know that she actually created this recipe, but probably Lucinda may have. Lucinda is creative. Lucinda Quinn is still around. I don't know where. I think she's on TV. I think she may have a podcast. But Lucinda and I met 40 years ago when she opened a jerk and beer joint in Harlem. Actually, it was the edge of Harlem. It was the no man's land between Columbia and Harlem. So she could attract both Columbia students and people from Harlem for jerk chicken and beer. Because she had lived in Jamaica for years, and she was really very good at jerk chicken.
All right. Well.
All right. So anyway, you know what I'm eating for lunch?
Well, let me know how it comes out next week.
Of course. I mean, we all need comfort food in the next 2 days, because who knows what's going to happen.
We're
all on edge.
That's right. Well, we're gonna. I eat a potato every night because it relaxes me. A baked potato.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Carbs are unquestionably covered. So we didn't have carbs, but my housekeeper's husband, who I'm very fond of, he's a chef, by the way, is now, because there are no restaurants to work in. He's working in an ice cream parlor where they do, you know, scooping.
Right.
And it's a kosher ice cream parlor. And since there are so many diabetics among Jews, they have a whole range of flavors of no-sugar ice creams. So Irene brought me some last night. Now they have no sugar soft serve.
Oh, well,
yeah, that was really good. They had both vanilla and pistachio. I have to say, all the flavors here are a little overdone. So, like, the butter pecan, which is not really a butter flavor but an almond flavor, had too much almond extract. And the pistachio was a little over pistachioed and a little too green, but you know, it made do.
All right, sitting there with a bowl of ice cream and eating it, it's hard to stop and go back to get another bowl. That's what I can tell you.
Well, I know, but I'm on a diet where we're allowed all the fat we want.
God bless you.
So in fact, you're better off eating fat than anything else on this. I discovered this. I had a really fatty day a couple of days ago. I was down a whole pound the next day.
All right.
It was a bacon for breakfast day. Okay. No eggs, just the bacon. A lot.
All right. Well, we'll speak to you next week, Arthur.
All right. Chicken and shallots. Bye-bye.
Take care. Arthur Schwartz, the food maven here on Robin Hood Radio, robinhoodradio.com on the web.
Underwriting support for Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, John Andrews Restaurant on the Hillsdale Road in South Egremont, 413-528-3467, and on the web, jarestaurant.com. Rubiner's Cheesemongers and Groceries on Main Street in Great Barrington, 413-528-0488, rubiners.com. Hillsdale Home Chef, more information, 518-325-7000, HGSHomeChef.com.